barely missing his eye. He rolled away from where he was, came up in a crouch, and took cover behind a table.
Bill, you okay?
I want these sons of bitches.
Hennessy's not a worry.
Dead?
Yep.
Hear that, Bernie? Bill taunted. Your hired gun is in hell.
Their repartee had given Thatcher time to scan the room. He couldn't see Gert, but figured she was behind the bar, reloading. It had to have been Croft's shot that had struck the floor near him, which gave him an idea of the mayor's accuracy. He wasn't a bad shot. He waited, crazy to know where Laurel was. Was her neck broken? Her back? Had she hit her head and was lying unconscious and defenseless? Croft showed his head above the bar. Both Thatcher and Bill fired a volley. Soda pop bottles shattered against the back of the bar, but Thatcher got no indication that Croft had been hit. Where was Gert and that goddamn shotgun? Bill was off to Thatcher's left. When Croft raised his head again, Bill fired two shots. Thatcher used the cover to take up another position. He still couldn't see Laurel. He couldn't place Gert either, and that bothered him. He would have expected another blast from the shotgun by now, unless one of their shots had struck her and she was down. Couldn't count on that. Too much to hope for. He had to know where Laurel was and if she was hurt. From his present vantage point, he couldn't see the bottom of the staircase, where he featured her, crumpled, broken, bleeding. Croft was keeping him and Bill pinned down. A shadow fell across the screen door. Croft fired at it. The shadow disappeared. Thatcher, who was nearest the door, whispered,
"Who's that?"
"Scotty."
"Hennessy's dead. Croft's behind the bar. Have you seen Gert?"
"No. Mrs. Plummer?"
"Alive when we got here, now."
Thatcher couldn't bring himself to venture a guess.
"What do you want me to do, Thatcher?"
"Stay put, but be ready."
While carrying on the whispered conversation with the deputy through the screen, Thatcher had reloaded. Bill, who'd been exchanging pot shots with Croft, also had to pause to reload. Thatcher waited until he was done, then motioned to Bill that he was going to intentionally draw Croft's fire, giving Bill a chance at him. Bill acknowledged. Thatcher took a breath, then surged to his feet and ran toward the staircase, banging into tables, overturning chairs, reaching across his torso to fire back toward the bar. Croft took the bait. As soon as he showed himself, he and Bill exchanged a barrage. From beneath his left arm, Thatcher turned and fired three rounds at Croft before diving beneath a table. He rolled onto his back and fired toward Croft again, but he had disappeared behind the bar. Thatcher flipped the table onto its side and hunkered behind it so he could reload.
"Bill?"
"Bernie's hit. Wounded, at least."
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah."
Thatcher knew that wasn't true. He was breathing like a man who'd been hit. But where? How bad? He couldn't ask without also giving Croft the advantage of knowing.
"Bill, can you cover me?"
There was a grunt, then,
"Ready."
Thatcher sprang up and sprinted over to the staircase. There was no sign of Laurel, not below, midway, or above. She tumbled. On her way down, one body part or another struck every tread of the steep staircase. She landed hard. The wind was knocked out of her.
"Laurel!"
The first time Thatcher had called out to her, Hennessy's hand had been over her mouth. She couldn't respond this time either, because she hadn't regained her breath, and Gert had been waiting for her at the bottom of the staircase. She crammed a soured dishcloth into Laurel's mouth and lifted her off the floor. The madam was more solidly built even than Hennessy and seemed twice as strong. She was certainly as mean and merciless. Laurel struggled, but without the use of her arms and with every inch of her body pulsing in pain, she was virtually defenseless. But she'd be damned before she gave up. In an attempt to get Thatcher's attention, she banged her heels against the hardwood floor. But as she did, gunfire exploded, seeming to come from all directions at once and drowning out the sound. Gert hit her on the temple with the barrel of the shotgun, dazing her. She had the will but not the coordination to resist when she was dragged past the bar, into a narrow passage, and through a door. The area into which Gert shoved her was darker, cooler, and smelled of booze. Head still reeling, she realized that she was in Lefty's infamous back room. In the front room, Thatcher was in a gunfight. Thatcher could die. That prospect was more terrifying to her than the actuality of Gert, who was standing over her, loading shells into her shotgun. When she snapped it closed, she crammed the barrels beneath Laurel's chin. And Laurel's last thought? I love Thatcher. Thatcher stared at the emptiness at the bottom of the staircase. Laurel was unhurt. She'd gotten herself to safety. No. If she'd been able to respond to his shouts, she would have. Unless she hadn't wanted to give away her position to Gert. Gert hadn't been behind the bar reloading. She'd abandoned Bernie to fight it out with Bill while she was settling her grudge against Laurel. But if Gert had fired the shotgun, he would have heard it. Laurel would be dead at the bottom of the stairs. Gert had a reason for keeping Laurel alive. Hostage. Okay, so where had Gert taken her? The back room. Had to be. Thatcher processed all this within a millisecond. By the time he'd completed the last thought, he was already moving in the direction of the back room. But as he reached the open space at the end of the bar, he was met with a hail of bullets. He fell back and ducked under the counter. He waited, breathing hard but as quietly as possible. He would be no help to Laurel dead. His mind tapered down to the single purpose of killing Bernie Croft, now. Gun hand extended, he stood up and moved into the space at the end of the bar, intentionally making himself an easy target. Croft was lying on his back in a pool of soda pop and his own blood. He must have spent all his bullets in that last barrage, because the pistol lay on the floor at his side. Thatcher drew a bead on him. Croft's eyes showed stark fear, but he couldn't speak for the blood bubbling from his mouth. He was frantically clawing with both hands at the multiple bullet wounds in his torso. His bloody watch fob kept getting in the way of his futile attempts to stanch the gushers of blood. It would be a mercy kill. To hell with that. Thatcher lowered his gun.
Scotty?
Scotty and the other two deputies rushed in, weapons drawn. Already on the move, Thatcher said,
"See to Bill. Croft's gut shot.
Dead?"
"Yeah. He just hasn't stopped breathing yet. Two of you follow me."
Thatcher ran into the dark, narrow passage behind the bar that led to the back room.
"Laurel!"
He tried the door. It was locked.
"Laurel!"
He put his shoulder to the door. It burst open just as two gunshots were fired.
"You're my ticket out of here, princess."
Gert yanked Laurel to her feet and began hauling her across the room toward a rear door. Having taken several blows to the head, the sudden movement sickened her. Bile filled the back of her throat, but she knew that with that disgusting rag in her mouth, she would choke to death if she retched. She forced down the fiery bile. The shooting in the front room had stopped. She heard scuffling footsteps and shouting, but the only distinct word she heard was her name. Hearing Thatcher's voice coming nearer spurred her, imbued her with energy she would have thought unattainable. More than that, it filled her with die-hard determination not to let this ogress defeat her. She jammed her feet against the floor, trying to halt or slow Gert's progress.
"Move! I'll shoot you!"
Laurel didn't believe she would. She was Gert's bargaining chip, but only for as long as she stayed alive. A thumping noise came from beyond the door behind them.
"Laurel!"
"Shit," Gert muttered. Try as she might, Laurel couldn't match Gert's strength, and they reached the back entrance. She still held the shotgun beneath Laurel's chin, but Laurel thought that if she could hold out for just a moment longer. Gert reached around her and pulled open the door. Corinne was standing within 2 feet of the threshold. Taking advantage of Gert's surprise, Laurel lunged sideways. Corinne stretched out her arm and fired 2 rounds point blank into Gert's throat. Thatcher crashed through the door in time to see Gert drop the shotgun. She clutched her throat with both hands and staggered backward as blood spurted from between her thick, tobacco-stained fingers. She landed on the floor like a felled redwood, her eyes wild. Even before they went unseeing, Thatcher was kneeling beside Laurel and yanking a rancid dishcloth out of her mouth. In seconds, he had her hands untied. He ran his hands over her to reassure himself that she was intact. She placed her hands on his chest, saying in a rush of breath,
"She caught me at the foot of the stairs and stuffed that cloth in my mouth. I couldn't call out to you."
He pulled her to him and placed his chin on the crown of her head. He looked at Corinne.
"How do you get here?"
"Irv and them deputies setting up the roadblock got into an argument over who was moving what vehicle first. It got to be a real pissing contest. Ain't that just like men? I run off while they weren't looking."
She grinned and extended her hand, palm up, on which lay the small derringer.
"I come to give Miss Laurel her pistol back."
60. The JP was summoned to declare Bernard Croft, Jimmy Hennessy, and Gertrude Atkins dead. Lefty, who seemed relieved rather than upset to learn that Gert had departed this life, was taken in for questioning and to sleep off his bender. He would keep Gabe Driscoll company in the cell block that night. Bill had taken a bullet in the thigh. It had missed major blood vessels, but was buried in the muscle and would need to be surgically removed. Irv offered to transport him to town in the back of his truck. Deputies carried him over and placed him in it. Laurel insisted she would be fine when her head cleared, but everyone else, especially Thatcher, was just as insistent that Dr. Perkins should check her over. He personally tucked her into the back seat of Bill's car, drove her to the clinic himself, and hand-delivered her to the doctor and a nurse. They gowned her and left her lying on the table in the examination room, where Thatcher was granted a private moment with her while they assembled what they would need to treat her mild injuries. She scooted over, creating a spot for Thatcher to sit. He clasped hands with her and looked her over. "Do you hurt anywhere?"
"A little bit everywhere. Bumps and bruises, mostly."
"Your head?" He wasn't sure she was aware of the large bruise on her temple.
"The nurse already gave me aspirin powder. What happened there?"
Tenderly, she touched the cut beneath his eye made by the wood splinter.
"Nothing."
She kissed her fingertip and barely touched it to the scrape.
"I have some good news. Mike O'Connor is in a room down the hall. He's holding his own," Dr. Perkins said. "He predicts a full recovery. But he also told me that in a lucid moment, Mike vowed on his St. Christopher medal to get revenge for Davy."
"Maybe he'll have a change of heart."
"I doubt it,"
she said wistfully. So did Thatcher, actually. To get her off that subject, he said,
"You and Corinne will have to give your statements about what happened with Gert. It'll be a formality."
"Of course."
"But I have one question. Why did Corinne have your pistol?"
"When all the trouble started happening in the hills, I was afraid for her safety, even though Ernie..."
"Who's Ernie?"
She smiled.
"I'll tell you about him sometime."
He fingered a strand of her hair.
"I think we both have a lot to tell each other."
"Give me a hint."
He softly kissed her lips. As he eased away from her, she whispered,
"I can't wait to hear the rest."
From the other side of the door, Dr. Perkins cleared his throat.
"Mr. Hutton, they need your help with Sheriff Amos downstairs."
"Be right there."
He stood and bent over Laurel.
"I'll see you later."
"Yes, however late it is."
As he backed toward the door, they stretched out their arms, keeping their fingers touching for as long as possible before they fell away. Thatcher exited a door in the rear of the building where Irv's truck was parked. As he approached it, he overheard Corinne saying to Irv,
"Miss Laurel said you'd have a hissy fit if you knew she'd given me her little gun, but good thing she did. I can't wait to tell Ernie about Gert. He'll be so proud of me."
Deputies were grouped around the tailgate, talking quietly among themselves. Thatcher felt a kick of apprehension.
"What's the matter?"
"He won't come out," Scotty said.
"What do you mean? He can't walk.
Lift him out and carry him." "We tried. He threatened to fire all of us. He said he wouldn't go under the knife till he had talked to you."
"Thatcher," Bill called. "Get in here."
The others shuffled aside as Thatcher made his way to the raised tailgate and looked over it into the bed of the truck. Bill was lying on his back, sweating profusely and in obvious pain.
"What the hell, Bill? Doc's got everything ready for you upstairs."
"I need to talk to you. Get in," You others,
he said, raising his voice,
make yourselves scarce.
Thatcher lowered the tailgate and stepped up onto it, saying over his shoulder,
give us a few minutes.
Thatcher?
He paused and looked back. Harold was threading the brim of his hat through his fingers. It seemed like he'd been appointed the spokesperson.
You did okay out there today. I mean, damn good.
The others nodded.
We'd all take you out for a beer, except, well, you know, this dang prohibition.
The awkward invitation was their way of apologizing for the slights. Thatcher bobbed his chin.
A beer would go down real good. Some other time.
They all breathed a collective sigh. Scotty said,
we'll wait over here.
They moved away as a group, giving Bill the privacy he'd asked for. Thatcher hunkered down beside him.
What's this bullshit about?
Legs hurting like a bastard.
Then let us get you in there so the doc can fix you up.
I'm scared of ether.
He'll sleep it off.
I sent one of the men to tell Daisy. Hated to. Alice Cantor sent back word that she's doing a lot better. Got some scrambled eggs down her. She'll bring her to see me tomorrow.
That's good news. Let's go.
Bill caught Thatcher by the sleeve.
Something else.
He settled his head on the floor of the truck and stared at the tarpaulin stretched overhead.
Soon as I'm able, I'll be turning myself in. I took Bernie's bribes. Let Hiram, others, get away with murder. Like killing that boy, Elray. He'll be on my conscience for a long time.
Thatcher wanted to say mine too, but Bill didn't give him a chance.
Being lax kept things peaceful, but I'm a crook same as the rest. Past time I owned up to it.
He blinked sweat from his eyes and grimaced with pain.
This confession can wait, Bill.
No, it can't.
He returned his gaze to Thatcher.
If I were to die on that table, you'd never know unless I tell you now, and that would be a tragedy.
You're not in your right head, Bill. You're talking nonsense.
He clutched Thatcher's sleeve tighter.
From the start, I saw in you.
He made a dismissive gesture.
I already told you why I wanted you to work with me. Tim, all that. I wanted it bad enough. I lied to keep you here.
His face contorted, and it wasn't sweat in his eyes, Thatcher now realized. It was tears. He choked on his next words.
I told you that your Mr. Hobson had died.
61. The house was two-story, with a white clapboard exterior trimmed in sky blue. Thatcher was relieved to see that it was as nice a house as the growing city of Amarillo afforded. He went through the gate of the iron picket fence and up to the front door. His knock was answered by a gray-haired gentleman with a benign smile and gentle brown eyes behind wire-rimmed eyeglasses. Thatcher had been told that he was a prosperous accountant.
You must be Mr. Hutton.
He extended his right hand and shook. I'm George Maxwell. We received your telegram yesterday afternoon. Ever since, he's been watching the clock like a hawk. Thatcher was led through the main rooms of a house that smelled like lemon oil and homemade bread. The bedroom he was ushered into was bright, with sunlight filtered through gauzy curtains. A woman who was bent over the bed, adjusting the covers, straightened up and turned as she heard Thatcher enter.
Welcome, Mr. Hutton. My name is Irma.
Ma'am?
Would you care for something to drink?
Thank you, but I'm okay for now.
She gave him an understanding smile.
Then I'll leave you to your reunion.
As she passed him on her way out of the room, she said,
Bless you for coming.
She and her husband withdrew and closed the door behind them. Thatcher almost wouldn't have recognized the person on the bed. His memory was of an average-sized man, but one who had seemed larger than life, a man robust enough to fit into the seemingly endless landscape that he'd lived on, worked on, and loved. Propped against a stack of fluffy pillows, he looked diminished. The stroke had paralyzed his left side and distorted that half of his face. The eye was permanently closed, his mouth drawn downward. No, Thatcher might not have recognized Mr. Henry Hobson, Jr., but Mr. Hobson recognized him. His right eye was lit up with joy. He raised his right hand and reached out toward Thatcher. Although his countenance and reduced form were unfamiliar, Thatcher would have known that calloused, crusty hand anywhere. It had taught him how to rope and shoot and brand, how to pack a saddlebag, start a campfire and put it out safely, how to hold a poker hand, tie a necktie, and how to use his table manners. It had patted his shoulder in congratulations for achievements and had squeezed it with encouragement following failures. Just about anything worth knowing he had learned from Mr. Hobson, the principal lesson being that a man was only as good as his word. He crossed over to the bed and took Mr. Hobson's hand in his. "I promised you I'd be back." In his mind, Thatcher had replayed the telephone conversation with Trey Hobson's secretary and realized how the condolences he'd extended had been misconstrued as a reference to Mr. Hobson's debilitating stroke, not to his demise. The Maxwells told him that following the major stroke, Mr. Hobson had suffered several minor ones, and that his doctor predicted a cerebral event from which he wouldn't recover. "Irma has nursing experience," Mr. Maxwell explained. "Several years ago, we began making our spare room available to patients in Mr. Hobson's condition. When he was dismissed from the hospital, we had a vacancy and invited him to move in. His son agreed that being with us was preferable to a nursing home." And the kind couple were far preferable to Trey, Thatcher thought. The Maxwells gave him a bedroom on the second floor and treated him like an honored guest, but largely he was left free to pass the time with Mr. Hobson. His visit stretched into weeks. He and his mentor spent hours together in the homey bedroom. For the most part, Mr. Hobson stayed in bed, but occasionally Thatcher would move him into a chair where he had a better view out the window. He couldn't converse, but he was an attentive listener and expressed himself eloquently by using his right hand to gesture and his right eye to blink twice for yes, once for no. Thatcher read to him daily, either from the newspaper or from the dime novels he loved about the Wild West, cattle drives, and shoot-em-ups. Thatcher shared war stories, some funny, some harrowing. He told Mr. Hobson about his jump from the freight train and the unpredictable turn his life had taken since. He described in detail all the people with whom he'd become involved to one degree or another. As he talked about them, Thatcher realized that even those with whom he'd barely crossed paths and would never see again had been woven tightly into his memory and would stay there forever. He got angry all over again when he told Mr. Hobson about Bill's deception, the selfishness behind it, the betrayal of a man he'd come to respect. Mr. Hobson didn't immediately respond, and then he moved his right hand laterally, parallel to the ground, as though saying, "Let it pass." And of course, Thatcher talked about Laurel. He described her physically, but was frustrated by the inadequacy of his words. He groused about her stubborn streak, but admitted to Mr. Hobson that he'd lost his heart to her sassiness. He could have sworn the old man chuckled. Often, Thatcher just sat with him, saying nothing, hoping that Mr. Hobson was as content simply being in his presence as much as Thatcher was simply being in his. It was during those quiet times that Thatcher reflected on his experience of the past several months and began to realize that there might have been a purpose behind everything that had happened, a governing why for that he hadn't perceived while he was living it. He wondered if Mr. Hobson somehow, even in his limited capacity, had influenced that insight. One morning, Thatcher asked Mr. Maxwell if he could borrow his car. "I'd like to drive out to the ranch." Having spotted the car's wake of dust from a mile away, Jesse was waiting for it outside the bunkhouse, holding a shotgun across his chest. The dog, who was part wolf, sat growling at his side. When Thatcher stepped out of the car, Jesse dropped the shotgun, called off the animal, and although he was well past 70, ran out to embrace him, thumping him on the back and laughing. They opened a contraband bottle of mezcal and spent the day sharing it and recollections. They laughed with hilarity over some, Others made them pensive or downright sad. Thatcher was reunited with his saddle. It was on a stand inside the bunkhouse. Thatcher ran his hand over the smooth leather. It's never looked better, Jesse. Thank you for keeping it in good condition. When the old ranch hand asked about his former boss, Thatcher told him he'd considered packing Mr. Hobson into the car and bringing him along. But I think he's too frail to have made the drive out here. Thatcher gazed off into the distance, past the empty corrals and cattle pens where the dust had settled for good, and the whoops and hollers of rowdy cowboys would never be heard again. The magnificent span of the panhandle's horizon was now interrupted by the silhouettes of drilling rigs. Thatcher added, "And it would have broken his heart." When it came time for Thatcher to leave, his double-handed handshake with Jesse held for a long time in an unspoken acknowledgement that this was goodbye. One afternoon, Irma Maxwell knocked softly on the bedroom door, then came in carrying a plate with a sandwich on it.
"Since you didn't come to the table for lunch,"
she halted midway across the room. Thatcher's chair was pulled up close to the bed. His hand was wrapped around Mr. Hobson's. "He passed." He cleared his husky throat. "About 10 minutes ago. No event. It was dignified and peaceful." He spent that night with the Maxwells, but in the morning he came downstairs carrying his duffel bag already packed. He wanted to make a clean break before Trey arrived. Yesterday, when notified of his father's death, he'd told Mr. Maxwell that he couldn't get away until this morning. Thatcher didn't think he could be civil to the self-centered bastard, and it would be disrespectful to Mr. Hobson to create tension or cause a scene. Besides, attending a stuffy funeral, Mr. Hobson in a casket, him in a pew, didn't seem a fitting end to these meaningful weeks they had spent in each other's company. He declined the Maxwell's offer of breakfast before he left. "Thank you, but there's a train at 9:40. I'd like to make it." "Before you go," Mr. Maxwell went over to a chest and took a shoebox from one of the drawers. "When Mr. Hobson was moved in here with us, this was among his things." He handed the box to Thatcher. His name was written on top in Mr. Hobson's bold scrawl. Before he raised the lid, Thatcher heard the familiar jingle and knew what he would find inside. Mr. Hobson's spurs, still dirt-encrusted from his last ride. 62. Not entrusting his saddle to the baggage car, Thatcher boarded the train with it on his shoulder. He set it in the seat in front of him where he could keep an eye on it. He took the seat next to the window. To discourage interaction with other passengers, he pulled his cowboy hat over his eyes, slumped in his seat, and pretended to be asleep. The train chuffed out of the station. He must have dozed because he was roused by someone asking, "Is this seat taken?" "Damn." Thatcher shook his head. "No." "Ah, good. The cars are crowded." The passenger settled into the seat. "Where are you headed?" So much for discouraging conversation. Thatcher took off his hat and placed it on his knee. He put his thumb and middle finger into his eye sockets and rubbed them. "Abilene, then east from there."
"Back to Foley?"
Surprised by that response, Thatcher glanced at his seat partner, did a double take, then his right hand automatically went for his pistol.
"You're not wearing your gun belt. I checked as you boarded. I didn't want you to shoot me before I could explain myself."
The smile he flashed was not that of a pimp. In place of the gold tooth was a normal white molar.
"You thought you'd seen the last of Chester Landry, didn't you? Well, you have. And God, what a jerk he was. I'm glad to be shed of him."
He had medium brown hair that was wavy and loose, not slicked back with pounds of pomade. He was dressed in a conservative dark suit with a pinstripe vest and unremarkable necktie. Thatcher looked around to see if they were being observed, possibly to reassure himself that he wasn't dreaming. No one was paying him any attention except the man seated next to him. Thatcher said, "Who the hell are you?"
"Lewis Mahoney, Detective, Dallas PD."
I'll show you my badge if you insist, but that can be awkward, because I'm presently on loan to another agency, working undercover.
What agency?
I can't tell.
That's convenient.
Actually, it's a nuisance. Because I would like for you to believe me, Mr. Hutton. I'm sure you have questions. I'll answer those I can.
What happened to Randy?
He was drawing too much attention to himself. I was afraid that Croft was going to have him killed, so I had to get him out of there. I lured him to Dallas by promising him a position in my fictitious bootlegging operation. I took him to a speakeasy to celebrate his new employment. It was raided as planned. Dallas police arrested him as planned. I escaped arrest as planned.
Like at Lefty's. He made a wry face.
No, that wasn't planned. I just got lucky that night. Anyway, Randy. Arresting officers promised him clemency in exchange for names. That of Chester Landry topped his list, of course. Not the most loyal of acquaintances. A young man of meager character and negligible morals, but not deserving of having his throat cut by Jimmy Hennessy. He looked at Thatcher shrewdly. By the way, congratulations on that outstanding display of marksmanship. You're already a legend. I'll bet Wyatt Earp is pea green. Thatcher ignored that.
You know, some suspected me of being a secret agent.
Croft was convinced. You bedeviled him, Mr. Hutton.
I'm glad to hear it, but I'm talking about friends who figured me for a spy. I'd hate doing what you do, Mr. Mahoney.
Yes, you would. The integrity thing.
Doesn't it ever bother you to rat out people who've befriended you?
It would, if I didn't stay focused on the big picture.
Which is what?
First and foremost, I'm an officer of the law. I despise this Prohibition Act because it is already making lawbreakers out of law-abiding people and turning petty criminals into villainous racketeers. Croft, for example.
My understanding is that he was always corrupt.
Yes, but he hadn't gone so far as to murder anyone. Greed rid him of restraint. Even in the short time I knew him, I saw it happening, and it was frightening. Mark my words, Hutton. The next war this country fights is going to be against violent crime syndicates that give no quarter.
Like Davy O'Connor's assassination, firing the Johnson's house.
Exactly like that. Jesus, he said, shaking his head. For months I'd been coordinating a countywide raid. Several agencies working together, we were going to nail Hiram Johnson and Bernie Croft. He made a helpless gesture. Croft moved first. Hard and fast and without my knowledge. Incidentally, we've identified the men who ambushed the O'Connors. All were on Croft's payroll. They've got prices on their heads. Somebody will turn. We'll get them.
You went to Laurel Plummer that night and told her you wanted to make her an offer.
I was going to reveal myself for who I am and ask her to become an informant for me. In exchange, I would see to it that she and her associates would be granted clemency for moonshining. He chuckled. Looking back on it, it was a bad idea.
For putting her in danger like that, I would have killed you.
As I said, a bad idea. Again, he laughed softly. I don't advise getting on her fighting side. She has a wicked right hook. He worked his jaw laterally. When Thatcher didn't react, he said, I can see that you're not amused.
He paused as though seeking a better way to express himself.
Let me assure you that I'm often bothered about the betrayal aspect of my job. But I don't go after the small-timers like your Mrs. Plummer. I'm after the bad guys, the ones who would have ultimately gotten rid of her for no other reason than that she was becoming a pest.
Croft.
Or someone like a Chester Landry, but the real article.
I was afraid that was exactly what was going to happen.
I figured. Your protectiveness was apparent.
Thatcher didn't comment on that.
How do you know I'd be on this train?
I knew you were in Amarillo, and the reason for your being here. I'm sorry about your friend.
Thanks, but why were you keeping tabs on me?
He smiled, a genuine, unaffected smile.
First, because you're damned interesting. Then, because the more I saw of you, the more I came to believe that you had missed your calling.
He withdrew a business card from the pocket of his vest and handed it to Thatcher.
There's a good man, a sheriff, in Bynum. Know it?
No.
East Texas. Pretty country. Piney woods, lakes full of fish. Bynum's a sleepy little town where not much happens, except that on the county line there's a horse racetrack. He punched Thatcher in the arm as he said that. Racetracks draw sinners, like moths to flame. But now that there's no legal drinking or gambling, the sinners are restless, and the sheriff has more than he can handle. Think about it.
He scooted out of the seat.
My stop is coming up. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. I trust in your integrity to keep this meeting to yourself. And should we ever meet somewhere?
I wouldn't give you away.
I know that.
He extended his hand. Thatcher shook it. Looking directly into Thatcher's eyes, he said,
I've enjoyed making your acquaintance, Hutton. Take care.
Then he turned and walked to the end of the car, opened the door, and stepped through to the next car.
63.
One morning, Laurel woke up with a grasp on that missed flicker of illumination she'd had after her night of lovemaking with Thatcher. She couldn't let it go or even leave it to languish. It was so long overdue, she was compelled to share it without delay. She dressed and went downstairs. Herb was finishing up his breakfast.
I left a pan of biscuits warming in the oven. Sit down, I'll pour you some coffee.
Let's go for a ride.
He turned to her, a puzzled look on his face.
Now? Where to?
Just come, please.
She lifted her straw hat off the peg and put it on, took down her purse, and went out through the back door. Mumbling something about nutty female notions, Irv followed. 10 minutes later, Laurel sat down on the narrow strip of grass between Pearl's and Derby's graves. She motioned for Irv to join her on the ground.
I won't be able to get back up.
Yes, you will. I'll help you.
He lowered himself to the ground on the other side of his son's grave.
What's going on, Laurel? What's the matter? Are you sad over him?
She knew he wasn't speaking of Derby. Thatcher had left without a word and hadn't come back. No one knew if he would. She cried herself to sleep most nights. She was in dire need of comforting. Yet the person who could ease her misery was the source of it. She was furious at him for that, but her yearning for him was like a sickness.
This isn't about him.
Told you not to trust him.
You did, she said softly.
Idly, she began pulling up the dandelions that had begun sprouting on Pearl's grave.
Something's come to me recently.
A package?
No, she said, smiling. Nothing tangible, although I do consider it a gift of sorts.
I think when Gert clouted you on the head, she knocked something loose.
She laughed softly.
You might be right, in which case I have her to thank for this.
He opened his mouth to say more, but she held up her hand.
It's enlightenment. It's been trying to worm its way into my consciousness. I think, subconsciously, I wanted it to stay put. I've resisted facing it. But I woke up this morning with it firmly seated in my mind. And please stop looking at me like I belong in a loony bin.
Well, how am I supposed to be looking at you? You ain't making a lick of sense.
Then I'll make it plainer.
She dusted loose dirt off her hands.
Irv, you know how bitter I felt toward Derby for abandoning me.
You had a right to be.
Not really, because I also abandoned him.
What are you talking about?
I've never told you about our start. We met at a dance, which was forbidden to me, of course. I sneaked out and went with a girlfriend. Derby was handsome and fun, someone I knew my parents would disapprove. I'll admit that was a large part of the attraction. Our whirlwind romance and hasty marriage was my deliverance. Just 6 weeks later, he left for Europe. I was a bride. Then the war ended and he came home, to a wife. If he had returned with a shattered leg, I wouldn't have expected him to run sprints, would I? But in my selfishness and immaturity, I guess, I expected him to pick right back up where he'd left off, giddy in love, light-hearted, optimistic, oozing charm. But it soon became apparent that Derby was no longer that romantic hero. What's become clear to me is that unintentionally, applied pressure on top of the pressure he was already feeling. I didn't support him the way I should have.
Laurel.
No, please, let me get this out.
He dry-scrubbed his face with his hand and motioned for her to continue.
I cleaned and cooked and slept with him like a dutiful wife. I begged him to talk to me about the things that were haunting him. I pushed him to try this, to do that, to get help. I swear to you that I did all of this out of love. I hated that he was suffering and seemingly unreachable. But I've come to realize that what I considered encouragement must have sounded like harping to him. He even said so just before he shot himself. I'm sick of you nagging me about every goddamn thing. God knows I wanted to rescue him. But what he might have needed most was for me to stop flapping around him, dispensing advice, and just to be there, to hold him tight without saying anything. That's what I didn't do. I didn't allow him to face his fears within the cradle of my arms.
Irv frowned down at the turf over Derby's grave. There was still a slight mound that had yet to flatten out.
You're being too hard on yourself, Laurel. I told you, Derby always had that darkness in him.
I don't know that I could have fixed him, Irv. It's vain of me to think that I could have prevented him from taking his life if he was determined to do so. We'll never know. But given how damaged he obviously was, I didn't give him credit for struggling through each day as well as he could. I laid all the blame on him for what he did. That was unfair.
She reached across the grave and took Irv's hand.
You fault yourself for having to leave him when he was a boy. In your circumstances, you did the best you could. It was important for me to tell you that I could have done better by Derby.
He sat for a moment without saying anything, then squeezed her hand.
I couldn't have chosen a better daughter-in-law if I was to have picked you myself.
She had to clamp her lip between her teeth to keep it from quivering. He cleared his throat noisily and said,
Now that's done. Come hoist me up.
64. Thatcher walked from the train station straight to her back door, which stood open. He watched her through the screen door as she placed a circle of rolled-out dough into a pie tin and began working the edges with her fingers.
Fluting.
She started at the sound of his voice. For a span of 10 seconds, she held his gaze, then went back to what she was doing.
Go away.
Didn't you get my telegram?
With one flower-covered hand, she gestured toward the drain board, where the torn-up pieces of a telegram lay scattered.
I'm coming for you. You have your nerve. Get away from my house. I'm busy.
I had to go, Laurel.
She stopped fiddling with the dough, but kept her head down, looking at her handiwork rather than at him.
Sheriff Amos told me about Mr. Hobson.
How'd that come about?
Well, after days of hearing nothing from you and not knowing where you were, if you were alive or dead, I went to see the one person who might know what had happened to you. He was still recovering from the surgery.
Finished with the pie crust, she reached for a dishcloth and wiped her hands.
He told me about his lie.
She set down the cloth and looked at him sorrowfully.
That was an awful thing for him to do, Thatcher. Did you make it to Amarillo in time?
He opened the screen door and went inside.
He passed last Wednesday.
You got to see him?
Yeah.
He searched her eyes.
Laurel, I know it must have looked like I had run out on you, but I had to go, and I had to go right then before anyone could try to talk me out of it or delay it or whatever. And I don't regret that decision. I love the man, and I wouldn't give anything for the time we had together before he died. I don't blame you for being mad. Just please try to understand.
She had softened considerably.
Of course I understand, Thatcher. I was more afraid for your safety than mad.
She covered a laugh with her hand.
No, I was furious.
He smiled.
You had reason.
She glanced at the telegram she'd ripped up.
Where have you been since last Wednesday?
I made a side trip to Bynum.
In East Texas? That's more than a side trip.
We can talk about it later. Is Irv here?
No.
Are you expecting him?
He's staying out with Ernie and Corinne tonight.
Thatcher still didn't know who Ernie was.
Turn off the oven.
She placed her hands on her hips.
I'm in the middle of baking pies.
He went to her, put his hands at her waist, and drew her to him.
Turn off the oven.
Not long afterward, they lay naked and entwined, her hair as tangled around them as the bedsheet. He lay on his back with one knee raised, she with her head on his chest, which she lightly strummed with her fingertips.
I gave in way too easily.
Easy hell.
He cupped her bottom and scooted her hip up against his.
It took me 20 whole seconds to get you up the stairs.
She laughed, then took his hand and nestled it between her breasts.
No teasing. I truly am sorry that you lost Mr. Hobson.
I didn't lose him. He'll always be there.
Will you tell me stories about him?
He tilted his head down and tipped hers up so he could look into her face. He ran his thumb across her lips, but being too moved to speak, only nodded. She returned her cheek to his chest. After time, she asked,
What was in Bynum?
A job.
He felt her go still.
It's not a horse training job, is it?
No.
He lifted her off his chest and turned onto his side to face her. He laid it all out and was more worried than he wanted to admit when she didn't immediately embrace the idea.
It seems so random, she said. Where'd you hear about it?
He gave her a half smile.
I met a man on the train out of Amarillo. He told me about it.
It sounds good, Thatcher, but you could have the same job here.
It would be hard for me to work for Bill again.
I get that, but...
And I can't wear a badge and be married to a local moonshiner.
You haven't even asked me to marry you.
Will you marry me?
No.
He laughed and nuzzled her neck. Sliding his hand into the V of her thighs, he whispered,
You don't have to give me your answer right away.
He kept her occupied for the next half hour, rearranging her limbs to allow him access to enchanting spots, turning her this way and that to explore and entice, lazily mapping her sweet body with his hands and lips and tongue. He tormented her with his dalliances until she gasped, Now! He pushed into her, and the fever pitch that he'd aroused in both of them combusted. He emptied all the sadness and disappointment, uncertainty and longing that he'd experienced in the past few weeks into her. He was now convinced that everything that had happened since his leap from that freight car had been predestined. He'd been making his way home, but not to a place, to a person. He would only ever be home with this woman. Still breathing hotly, he rested his forehead against hers and pushed his fingers up into her hair.
I love you, Laurel.
I believe you do.
And you love me.
I'm thinking it over.
Nah, you love me, and you're gonna marry me.
You don't know that.
Yeah, I do. I have a knack.
He melded their mouths, and by the time he ended the kiss, he'd convinced her. The next morning, over breakfast, he said,
On our way to Bynum, I thought we'd stop over in Dallas and get married there. Spend a couple of nights in a hotel. In a hotel bed.
At the stove, she sent him a smile over her shoulder.
I've never been in a hotel, and I've only seen the skyline of Dallas from a distance. Tell me about Bynum.
It's pretty, green, lots of trees. I looked at a house that has a barn.
You could keep horses.
I could teach you to ride.
She carried over a plate of hotcakes and set it in front of him. Lips smiling against his ear, she whispered,
You already did.
He pulled her onto his lap.
You took to it good, too.
He lowered his head and snarled against her breast. She pushed him away.
Stop that. Irv could come in. What's the kitchen in this house like?
Large and airy. You could bake to your heart's content. I'll bet you could sell slices of pie at the racetrack.
There's a racetrack?
Mm-hmm.
His hand had ventured inside her housecoat and was toying with her nipple through her nightgown. It causes some excitement, but otherwise it's a sleepy little town where nothing much happens. His mouth replaced his plucking fingers. She leaned her head back and gave him access. Faintly, she said,
"Your hot cakes."
They got cold. Thatcher went to the boarding house. Mrs. May greeted him with her characteristic geniality.
"Don't think you're crawling back, 'cause I done rented your room."
She'd packed everything in his trunk and put it in her root cellar. He retrieved his belongings and happily left the place for the last time. He went from there to Fred Barker, literally with hat in hand, and profusely apologized for having left without notifying him.
"I didn't even return the rifle you loaned me."
"No, never mind," Barker said. "Sheriff sent a deputy over with the rifle and a note, explaining. Afraid some of the owners of the horses you were training came to get them."
"I don't blame them a bit."
That week, he worked at the stable several hours a day, exercising the horses belonging to Barker. On his last day, as he was about to leave, he said,
"I'll always be in your debt for hiring me that first day."
"I ain't ever been sorry for it. Never saw a horseman good as you. I'm gonna miss having you around. Roger's plumb heartbroke."
They shook hands.
"Good luck to you, Thatcher."
Thatcher tipped his hat and walked away. Barker called after him.
"I like them spurs."
Thatcher smiled back at him.
"I'm gonna try to earn them."
Bill was sitting in one of the rockers on his front porch when Thatcher drove up in Laurel's car. He got out and walked to the porch. As he sat down in the second chair, he motioned toward the cane propped against Bill's.
"How's the leg?"
"Okay, just aches. Some days worse than others."
For a time, neither said anything. Then Thatcher asked after Mrs. Amos.
"I'm taking her to Temple. They've got a 3-month program, but she hasn't had a drop since the arsenic thing. She wants to get well. We've been talking a lot about Tim. I think she's finally come to terms. The other day, we even laughed over something he'd done when he was a boy."
"That's good, Bill. That's real good. She'll be all right, I'm sure of it."
Bill waited a moment, then said,
"Mila Driscoll's body was recovered."
"No trouble locating it?"
"Not after I passed along your description of that rock pile. Her uncle took her remains to New Braunfels for burial."
"Driscoll?"
"The sorry son of a bitch has fired 2 defense lawyers already, and they were glad of it. The judge granted a change of venue, so at least he's off our hands. If the state doesn't hang him, he'll spend the rest of his life behind bars."
He looked over at Thatcher.
"You'll probably be subpoenaed to testify when he comes up for trial."
"I'll be there."
"Patsy Kemp took Norma's baby boy and moved to Colorado to join her husband. They never could have kids, so they're happy to have him. I told her we suspected that Bernie Croft had fathered the boy, and that in all probability he'd been the one to assault Norma. She was shocked. She'd never met Bernie, only knew him to be the mayor."
"Miss Blanchard took that secret to her grave. I wish she'd kept the one that got her killed."
Bill gave a solemn nod, then said,
"Still looking for Chester Landry. He's nowhere to be found. That one is slippery as owl shit."
"Yeah."
They rocked in silence until Bill said,
"They charged me with misdemeanors only. Gave me 1 year and probated that."
"You're not a crook, Bill. You just got caught up and couldn't get out."
"Naturally, first thing I did was tender my resignation, but there's a group of county officials already urging me to run for re-election when the probation is up. Can you believe that?"
"Yeah, and I'd bet on you winning."
"How sure are you?"
"Royal flush, sure. This is Texas."
The two laughed lightly. Then Bill's smile gradually faded until his mustache drooped.
"I heard you leaving."
"Tomorrow."
"Bynum, I've met the man you're going to be working with."
"He mentioned it at a Sheriff's Association meeting?"
"In Austin, a while back, before the war. He's a good man."
He stared into the near distance. After a time, he said,
"You could stay here at Thatcher, take over while I'm on probation."
"No, that should be Scotty."
"You'd be leaving anyway, though, wouldn't you?"
He hung his head.
"For what I did, I apologize, Thatcher."
Thatcher made the gesture that Mr. Hobson had, a silent grant of forgiveness. "That's not the reason I'm going." Before continuing, he waited until Bill had raised his head and was looking straight at him. "This is your place, Bill. You found it, or it found you, but it's where you were meant. I need to make my own place."
"With Laurel Plummer? I trust she's going with you."
"If I have to strap her to the back of the car."
"How will you two reconcile your job with her moonshining?"
Davy O'Connor getting killed shook her to the core. When she started out, she underestimated the danger, but seeing firsthand all the blood spilled, she sworn off. From now on, she wants to stick to pie baking.
"Well, I wish you all the luck."
"Thanks. You too." Thatcher stood. Bill used his cane and pushed himself to his feet. They shook hands. Bill said,
"I'm not proud of lying to you, Thatcher, but God help me, I can't regret that I did."
Smiling at Bill from beneath the brim of his hat, Thatcher said,
"Me neither."
Laurel returned home after running errands to find Irv and Mike O'Connor in conversation beside Irv's truck. She had visited with him several times during his recovery. He was still paler and thinner than he'd been before he'd been shot. The twinkle in his eyes had dimmed, and it would probably be a while before they regained their full wattage, if they ever did. But when she alighted from her car and walked toward them, the familiar dimple appeared in his cheek.
"Ah, here's the lovely Laurel. I've been waiting on you."
Irv made his excuses and went into the house.
"I understand that tomorrow's the big day. I thought I ought to come say my goodbyes to you now, in private, while your sullen cowboy wasn't lurking about."
"You and I have nothing to hide from Thatcher."
"More's the pity."
He slapped his hand over his heart like a wounded, rejected suitor, and she could have sworn he was Davy.
"If that lucky bastard ever treats you bad, promise you'll come find me? I'll rub him out."
She laughed lightly. "I promise." He reached into his pants pocket.
"I have a going-away present for you."
He took her hand and dropped a St. Christopher medal and chain into her palm.
"Mike."
Taken aback, she stared down at the gold necklace, then looked up at him, so touched her eyes turned misty.
"Is it?"
"Yes."
"I can't accept it. You should keep it."
"I have a matching one, and Davy would love knowing it was dangling around your pretty neck. He and St. Chris are now your guardian angels."
He lifted the necklace out of her hand and slipped it over her head. She pressed the medal against her chest. They looked at each other, both unable to speak, so they hugged. When he released her, he said gruffly,
"Be happy, Laurel."
He tipped his cap and walked away. Everything they were taking was piled up in the empty living room. Thatcher's saddle sat atop his trunk. Laurel had packed her clothing in the same suitcase she'd had with her the night she'd arrived at the shack with Derby. She was taking Pearl's baby clothes and all the recipes in her mother's handwriting. Most everything else she was leaving behind because it would be needed. Corinne and Ernie had decided to move into the house.
"I love the idea,"
Laurel said to Corinne.
"You couldn't stay out there during the winter months.
Ernie and me could live in the shack and be just fine."
"But why would you when there's a hole upstairs here that would be going to waste? Stop trying to talk yourself out of it. The decision has been made. Besides, I'll feel better knowing that someone is here looking after Irv."
Corinne watched as Thatcher and Ernie, who had finally been introduced, began to load Laurel's car.
"It's not going to be the same without you here, though," the girl said wistfully.
"No, but you have the post office box key. I'll be writing to you at least once a week, so don't forget to check it.
If it weren't for you, I couldn't read them letters you'll send."
Laurel reached out and pulled the girl to her.
"I'm going to miss you."
"Me too, Miss Laurel."
Lowering her voice, she said,
I wouldn't trust you to nobody but him, she said, casting a glance at Thatcher as he swung his saddle onto his shoulder. He's quality.
Yes, he is.
As they broke their hug, Corinne dashed a tear from her eye, then said,
Oh, hell, Ernie, you're going to bust open that suitcase carrying it like that.
She went over to instruct and assist him. Laurel went in search of Irv and found him in his room. He was sitting on his barrel seat, staring at the floor.
What are you doing in here? She asked.
The girl told me I was getting in the way more than helping. And she's right. Arm still hurts if I move it a certain way, and this damn bum hip.
He muttered the rest, but she knew that his crankiness wasn't due to his ailments or Corinne's criticism. She sat down on the end of his bed, facing him, and said softly,
I'm going to miss you too, terribly.
Frowning, he said,
It ain't too late to change your mind. I've worked the rails over there in East Texas. It ain't like here. It's humid. They got mosquitoes as big as turkeys. Alligators?
I don't think there are any alligators in Bynum.
He harumphed. She reached for his hands and held them.
Be careful with your new enterprise.
His bushy eyebrows shot up.
Enterprise?
She gave him a look.
The first giveaway was catching you in a tete-a-tete with Mike O'Connor yesterday. I thought you didn't trust his dimples.
Who said I do?
She continued.
Another giveaway is all that busy work you and Ernie have been doing down in the cellar. Did you really think I would believe that you two are opening a machine shop?
Why not?
A machine shop with a mirror along one wall?
He gave up the pretense.
With Gert dead, Lefty abandoned the roadhouse. Nobody knows where he ran off to. The county's condemned the building. The girl remembered that long mirror, so we helped ourselves to it and the gramophone. They'll give the place some class.
I suppose you'll serve Ernie's moonshine. Is Mike supplying the bootleg liquor?
He's got some good connections.
I'm sure.
The girl will make snacks to serve.
When do you open?
Soon as you and Hutton clear town.
Does this speakeasy have a name?
Blind Tiger.
She laughed.
Isn't that rather obvious?
The girl likes the way it sounds.
He tipped his head toward the kitchen where Thatcher could be heard responding to Corinne's chatter.
Will you tell him?
He's going to be my husband.
He's going to be a lawman.
But he hasn't been sworn in yet. One thing, though, will there be girls?
Hell no. I'm too old. Ernie's too much in love, and the girl would never hear of it.
What about your fix-it business?
I'll keep it up, for show.
Just promise me that you'll be careful, Irv. Keep it exclusive. Locals only. People you know. No roughnecks.
Like I said, classy. Discreet-like. Hush-hush.
Don't let Mike take unnecessary risks.
None of us wants to get shot at again.
If things get hot,
we'll head for the hills. Don't you worry none.
I will.
I know.
She patted him on the knee, then stood and placed her hands on either side of his face, tipped his head down, and kissed his bald pate.
You've become very dear to me, Irv. Thank you for taking care of Pearl and me, for everything.
His eyes filled. He wiped his nose with the back of his hand and came off his barrel seat.
I'd better go see if I'm good for something.
Another round of goodbyes was set outside. As they pulled away, Thatcher reached across the seat and placed his hand on Laurel's knee, giving it a squeeze.
Are you sad?
Melancholy.
She looked back to see the three of them still there, waving. Then, as one, they turned and filed back into the house.
But they're a family. I had become the odd man out.
As they drove past the cemetery, Thatcher switched the Model T into low gear. Do you want to stop for one last visit?
No, Irv and I were here only a few days ago. He's promised to keep the graves well tended.
She didn't share the conversation she'd had with Irv about Derby, but she said,
When I think about Pearl, I don't think of her being in the ground. I think of her sweet face looking up at me as she nursed.
I'm not leaving her here. I'm taking her with me.
Thatcher pulled her closer, and she rested her head on his shoulder.
It was thoughtful of you to ask. Thank you.
They continued on their way, but she felt pressed to be candid with him.
Thatcher, we've joked about my accepting your proposal, but marrying you is a bigger step for me than you realize.
He pulled the car off the road onto the shoulder and gave her his undivided attention.
I've known that, but your past with Derby is your private business. I didn't want to dig into it until you invited me to.
Which I appreciate, but you should know this.
Okay.
After he did what he did, I vowed that I would never again surrender control of my life to someone else.
I don't want control over you, Laurel. I want you. If you're scared of marriage, we don't have to do it. A piece of paper isn't going to make me any more bound to you than I am.
You'd be willing to do that?
Not overjoyed about it, but willing. I'd like it if you use my name, though. Not because I care what you call yourself, but because I wouldn't want people thinking bad of you or our children.
She touched his face.
You really do love me.
He took her hand and kissed her palm.
I really do. But I can be stubborn, too. I'll never stop asking you to be my wife.
I accept, Thatcher. I'll marry you today because you're incredibly wonderful and I love you with all my heart. But don't ever stop proposing. Ask me every day to marry you.
He grinned. If you swear always to say yes.
I will.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Blind Tiger, written by Sandra Brown, read by Jason Culp. Produced by Robert Van Kolken. Post-production by James Bennett. Blind Tiger is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2021 by Sandra Brown Management Limited. Audio production copyright 2020 by Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This book is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual events, locales, or persons, living or dead, is coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.